give for that wonderful phrase. To hear those three little words, that's all I'd live for the rest of my days. And what I feel in my heart, they tell sincerely. No other words can tell it half so clearly. Three little words, eight little letters, which simply mean I love you.
And before we go to Patricia D. O'Connor, I just want to let you know that Jonathan Mooney, who we just heard from, is going to be having a reading at 7 o'clock tonight at the Barnes & Noble in Astor Place. Again, I'm Julie Burstein, and I'm in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm just delighted to be able to be here with our next guest, who is here on every Wednesday, the third Wednesday of each month, Patricia T. O'Connor, and she answers all our questions about what makes for proper usage. She's written not only Woe Is I and You Send Me, but the new Woe Is I Junior, just out from Putnam. It's the Younger Grammar Phobes' Guide to Better English. And we'll be taking your calls later at 212-433-9692. Now, Patricia, I do have some young grammar phobes in my household, and the question that we're going to be talking about today came up at my family dinner table because I have a 12-year-old and an 8-year-old, both boys, and our family is rather loose in terms of language, so they hear salty language that their peers may not hear, and my 8-year-old has started repeating some of that language, and the other day, he gets in trouble with his friends, and he said, why are words that don't hurt anybody's feelings, and we can think about what those words are, bad words, but words like stupid are not a bad word. And so that led to my question to you is, how do words in our language become taboo, become the things that you don't want to hear out of your 8-year-old's mouth?
Right. Well, that was a very grown-up question for an 8-year-old, I must say, because the question of what makes a word dirty or naughty is a very old one. In the case of English, it goes back about 1,000 years to the Norman Conquest. I don't want to oversimplify this, but to a large extent, many of the words we consider obscene today are derived from Old Saxon and other Germanic languages, while their counterparts derived from Latin and Norman French were acceptable. And you see, what happened was...
Oh, that's interesting. So that the language root is part of why we find it unacceptable.
Well, in a sense, because you see, the new aristocracy in England 1,000 years ago after the conquest spoke French. So among the elite, Norman French was stylish. Saxon was considered crude. So over time, old Saxon terms were considered lower and lower in status, then vulgar, and eventually obscene. A lot of the ordinary terms that had been used routinely by people for ordinary bodily and sexual functions became dirty. And while Latin and French-derived words like copulate, fornicate, derriere, penis, pudendum, defecate, the whole nine yards, really, were not dirty in themselves and could be used in conversation.
And were thought more clinical, and this is what we call this thing or this
exactly.
act.
Exactly. While the four-letter equivalents in Anglo-Saxon were dirty. I don't want to oversimplify because we have bad words that came from Latin and from Norman French too, but I think in a broad sense, a lot of our old four-letter forbidden, the big naughty ones that you're not supposed to use, once were all right, and by consent or because of fashion, they became considered obscene.
And it's interesting, another thing that my son keeps asking about is, why do these words have such power that it upsets people? Mm-hmm. You know, can I say it in my head? And so it's very interesting to watch a child kind of come around the whole idea of what is allowed and what has power and what is not allowed and
well,
has
power. Well, that's also a very good question, because the whole issue of acceptable words, and I just spoke about obscenities, things having to do bodily and sexual functions that are usually done in private, there's another class several other classes of bad words. But very olden times, the worst words you could use were profanities and blasphemies.
Against God.
Against God or against religion or whatever. Then came the obscenities, the normal bodily functions that became taboo to talk about. And then more recently came personal insults. And these are the ones that your child is talking about are as hurtful. These are the racial and ethnic slurs, the abuses of a person's nationality, politics, handicaps, for example, gender, personal traits, being skinny, fat, wearing glasses, the whole megilla of personal name-calling. And these, of course, have always been with us, but in recent years, I think we've learned to see them as even more hurtful than profanity and obscenity. And it may be that our official attitudes towards banned words haven't quite caught up, but I think even children recognize that while saying some ordinary four-letter word out of anger or something may not wound someone, calling him fat or referring to his racial or ethnic background can be very wounding. And this, I think, is a good thing, this awareness that the most hurtful curse words are the ones that attack someone's humanity, what makes him or her individual, rather than, oh, well, here's a list of things that aren't meant to be referred to.
That aren't allowed in pleasant conversation.
Right.
And it is. I think that is the thing he's wrestling with, because those are the words he's starting to kind of play with, and those are mm-hmm. the things that his friend's parents send him out of the house and say,
yeah.
You don't say that in our house. So it's very interesting. But what you say about the sort of racial and ethnic and kind of physical epithets,
mm-hmm.
there's a new trend now, too, towards taking those things and owning them by
mm-hmm.
by the group that
sure.
formerly would have been very offended by them.
Mm-hmm.
And then also using the initial so that you can say the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been wondering about that transition from something that has a lot of power and a lot of hurt to something that is then owned to something that then becomes shorthand.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, this seems to be a natural evolution in what we think of as curse words. If you take this back and say, oh, sure, I'm fat. I belong to the National Association of Fat People. I think fat is great. And I wear a button saying, fat, isn't it terrific? Or something like that. Or, yes, I'm old. I'm elderly and I'm proud. So that you don't call someone an old bag and have it hurt anymore. Say, yes, I belong to the Society of Old Bags.
It diffuses the power in a way.
Yes,
that
yes.
the word is only powerful
right.
if we all agree this is a
That's
powerful,
right.
hurtful word.
We allow it to be powerful and hurtful.
As you thought about the whole kind of evolution of what is considered obscene or off limits, are there things that you see on the horizon that may? Do you have a sense of how things will shift going forward, or is that always mysterious?
That's hard to say. I do think that obscenities are going to lose more and more of their force. We're already hearing all kinds of things on television and radio and in song lyrics, and people are routinely using words that even, 50 years ago would have been scandalous or would have gotten you whooped by your mama. So I think that those things are losing their power. Profanities have lost their power. Profanities and blasphemies have lost their power. And I think that as we go on, more and more personal insults are going to lose their power. But I'm a little guarded about that, because people are very inventive in ways of hurting one another, and they're always going to be coming up with new things. So women may reclaim the C word or the B word or whatever, and have festivals devoted to these words. But there'll be other ones to take their place, because what gave birth to those words was not just language, it was hatred.
And a desire to do harm.
Yes, yeah.
So those were just words, but they became something else.
Right. And there probably always will be harmful words, unfortunately. I wish there weren't. I wish we could say whatever we wanted and not hurt anyone. But people want to hurt each other with words, and that's why these words are painful.
Well, we've done a very good job of talking about these words on the radio, where there are many of these words that we may not say. So this was good to kind of get a sense of where their power comes from, but know that we can't talk about them right here because this is not allowed. So that's, I think that may be also
That'll
a part of it.
That'll probably change eventually.
It may. Yes. But I wonder, too, whether that kind of prohibition also gives words a power when you say you may absolutely not use these words.
Oh, of course. Right. I remember a particular four-letter word that I was introduced to for the first time in first grade because a boy wrote it on a note, just that word, and passed it to me. And it didn't seem to make any sense to me. It wasn't any sound I'd ever heard. And so I said, that's not a word, teacher. Look, here's a non-word. He says it's a word. I know it's not. And so that's how I learned that it was indeed a word. And I've never forgotten that episode.
It sounds like it may have steered you on your track of finding out what these words are and where they come from, though.
Maybe that's how my career got its start. I don't know.
Well, we have lots of people calling in with different kinds of questions.
Good.
And so let me go to our first caller. We have Jim from Union City. Jim, what's your question for Patricia T. O'Connor?
Hi. In the debate leading up or around the immigration legislation, I heard actually two words used in the debate. One was that the Democrats were hanging fire, or the term to hang fire, and the Republicans were in their negotiations that the argument was wired.
Well, I'm not so sure how wired was being used, but to hang fire, I haven't heard that used in modern speech for a long time. Well, you know, it was popular with Henry James. If you're a Henry James fan, he uses hang fire about every 10 or 15 pages, it seems. And that's about the only place you can find it in the last 100 years. But it means basically to hesitate, to pause on the brink of doing something at a tense moment, and I don't know its derivation, but I'm surprised that it pops up again, but that's very interesting. Now, something is, how did the wired business
McLaughlin
come about again?
I believe it's from context, something that is negotiable, but it's sort of something you put forward as strenuously non-negotiable, only to bolster your fallback position.
And that means it's wired?
I'm assuming from how I've heard McLaughlin use it. But it was Gwen Ifill who used hang fire. And I was wondering if it was I did look it up, and it referred to firearms, so I was wondering if it was a deliberate or a delay, or is it a malfunction?
I think it's deliberate.
That's always
like
the way that I've
powder
heard it.
Or keeping your powder dry or something?
Well, I don't know about the firearms connection.
Huh.
Seems unlikely Henry James would have used a gunpowder term.
He was much more interested in social interactions than in warfare interactions.
That may be where it comes from. I'm sorry, I don't know.
Well, Jim, thank you so much. We have many more calls, so I'm going to go to Frank in Brooklyn. You have a question for Pat.
Yes, I do. I'm a geezer.
And you learn to take that back and use the power of geezer.
Yes. Power of geezerhood.
It's the G word that goes with grandfather. I was talking to my credit card company this week, and as usual, with corporations and all kinds of places, at one point in the conversations, I was actually talking to somebody, the young woman says to me, would you verify your name and address? And I'm always tempted. Sometimes I actually do say, yes, I'll be glad to do that, and wait for them to tell me my name and address so I can verify it. Now, is it proper to turn this thing around like that?
I don't see why not. If it's understandable and if...
Yeah, the thing is, I know what she means, so I should take it and not be offended by this misuse of the word verify.
Well, I'm not so sure it's a misuse.
I had a hunch you were going to tell me that.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
They may know everything about us anyway, so that verify is the right word.
Well, so, there you are.
Well, thank you so much, Frank. And next we have got Ken from Manhattan. You have a question for Patricia.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, Matthew Arnold, this critic, Victorian critic, once said when he was introducing the word Philistinism, mm-hmm. as you know, as a term of derogation,
mm-hmm.
to English, that maybe we, you know, English speakers, don't have the word because we have too much of the thing, and I was wondering if there might be a similar sort of situation going on in Spanish and Italian, as far as I know, and probably other languages. They have this word mediatic. coming off media in general. Yeah, and there's so many situations in which I think, whoa, you know, if only we had that word, it would come in so handy. Like, you know, you could talk about military industrial mediatic complex and stuff like this. You know,
I don't know.
Why don't we have it? Yeah.
Yeah, I've never heard the word mediatic. It's an adjective referring to media?
In Spanish or Italian, you bump into it pretty often.
Well, I'd rather not see it in English myself.
It's an awkward word. It's interesting to think about, though, what are the other words that could be used in that way in English?
Am I missing something?
Why not just use media as an adjective?
Media complex?
Yeah, why not? We use a lot of our nouns as adjectives also. There's, you know, the color blue is also an adjective. I don't see what's wrong with just settling for using media itself as an adjective.
Well, Ken, thank you so much for your call. I want to get to an emailer who has emailed us on the issue of bad words and has written, "Why decry the existence of bad words? We have need for such words. People do bad things and selfish things to others, and we have need to express our strong feelings about such people. The unfortunate thing in my mind is that these words and expressions lose their impact because of the near acceptance of them in everyday speech. When these lose their power, what words will we use to express strong feelings?"
Well, that's true. They're awfully handy for venting. And I would be dishonest if I didn't admit that I use them that way myself quite a bit.
I would be dishonest,
not on the radio.
Not on the radio, but that's, I think, where my 8-year-old got all of these words that he now uses.
But I'm pretty sure that when one word loses its power, when we no longer can say, "Oh, shucks," and feel any real, a real swelling of emotion, we'll come up with something stronger.
So that we don't have to worry that we'll run out of words that can express that incredible frustration or pain or whatever it is.
I don't see them running out anytime soon.
I kind of agree with you. We have also a couple of callers who have called about a previous caller about hang fire. So I'm going to go to Bob in Harlem. Bob, I've heard you have information about hang fire.
Yes, hang fire is derived from a bad thing in a firearm. When you pull the trigger and the bullet doesn't fire for a number of a perceptible time, that's called a hang fire.
But does the fire then come out? Does the bullet come out just not when you expected it to?
Right. And, you know, like back in the days of the flintlock, it could be as long as when you look down the barrel to see what happens.
Oh, dear.
But obviously, you know, the idea is that you're holding the firearm pointing where you want it to go, and if that doesn't move, then if the firearm doesn't move, you have a chance of hitting your target. If they're both moving, it's not good. You know, it's not going to happen.
And you don't want to move in between the firearm and your target at that moment.
Right.
Well, Bob, thank you so much. We also have a call from Judy in Chelsea about the Rolling Stones and hang fire.
Yes, I believe that the Rolling Stones used the term hang fire in a song. In fact, I think the song may have even been called Hang Fire.
Oh.
And as old as I sometimes feel, I think that that has been subsequent to the 100-year mark, you know. And on the topic of bad words, I would like to weigh in by saying,
you can't use any, by the way, because this is radio. I know
absolutely
you probably
not,
know that.
But many of them, if they're not the God-oriented ones, then they refer to bodily and sexual functions. And I think that this traces back to our disgust with the body. And it really irks me, and I know I do it myself, that I think bad person, bad action, and I equate it with something perfectly neutral or even nice, you know, i.e. something to do with the body or something to do with sex. Mm-hmm. It's because, you know, we've reduced the body to something awful. And therefore we equate mm-hmm. it with awful people and awful activities.
Mm-hmm. But sometimes for the exact same concept of a bodily function or a body part, there are good words and bad words. There are acceptable ways and unacceptable ways of mentioning them.
That's what you were talking about at the beginning, is that the derivative of
exactly.
where they came from affected how we felt about them. We have a caller right now from Easton, Connecticut. Richard from Easton, you have a question for Pat.
Yes, I do. Tell me, am I wrong to flinch when I hear even well-educated and well-read people say, I borrowed the money off of him, or I took the advice off of him, and I always thought it was from. But I hear it with such frequency now that I'm beginning to think there's something wrong with me. Is there something wrong with me?
No, I think that you probably have too keen an ear. Usually when we use off, we don't need of. Of is usually redundant, and sometimes the whole phrase can be replaced by from.
Well, thank you to everyone who's called in. I love to listen to this segment when I'm at home listening, and it's just been a pleasure to be here with you, Pat, to
Thanks,
talk
Julie.
About words. Patricia T. O'Connor is Leonard Lopate's word maven, and you can go to grammarphobia.com and click on Pat's blog to see a selection of language questions from WNYC listeners, and to ask a question, email her at grammarphobia.com. On tomorrow's show, guest host Alice Ree explores the offerings at the first-ever National Asian American Theater Festival here in New York. Then Michael Ondaatje tells us about his latest novel, and we ask photographers from Magnum about the challenges of covering major conflicts throughout the world. Plus, on this week's Underreported, we talk to refugees who have resettled in New York. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We have help today from Fran Jacobs, Stephen Valentino, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. And I wanted to add today that it's the last day for assistant producer Brenna Farrell. We will miss her. Thank you.